Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Today on Sticks In Friday, we're talking Final Four, Philadelphia. We will take a nice good look at both of the NCAA semifinal games as we figure out who's going to play for the D1 chip on Monday. And we will also talk about the PLL going city-based. It's the second time we're going to cover this topic in inside a month, so sort of. If you're enjoying the pod, please do leave a like, subscribe, review, 5 stars, thumbs up, whatever it is that platform that you listen to this on lets you do. Thank you for coming back again. Let's do it. Happy Friday, folks. Not just any Friday. Memorial Day weekend Friday. Leave work at 3 p.m. on Friday. Load up the cooler, head to the beach on Friday. Pack up the car and head to Philadelphia for 3 days of lacrosse. That is bookending the finish of the college and indoor season while also being the starting bookend of the PLL season. Yeah, that sounds good. Let's do that. I could not be more excited. I will be leaving at the crack of dawn on Saturday to get to Philadelphia for both of the Saturday games. I'll be taking in the D2 and D3 title games on Sunday. I will be enjoying the D1 title game on Monday. And I will be looking for a place that will nicely put on ESPNU or ESPN Plus for me to watch the NLL games as well. Before we get into the college weekend, there was the news today announced by the PLL. Going city-based. I know what you're thinking. Didn't we just do this? Yes, we did. On May 3rd, Sportico reported that this was happening this year. PLL did no comment on that story when it happened. Just as an aside, let's look at that for a second, I guess. Let's consider that situation for a second. I think it honestly has bearing maybe on a larger discussion here. It's interesting. So Sportico has, you know, done a lot of coverage of the PLL since launch. They've had a lot of scoops and breaking news things. Sportico, Scott Soschnick, the PLL, they have a good relationship as far as I can tell. There's some, you know, Soschnick reports really well on it. He gets some exclusives in there too. Everything there seems like it's all in great standing. They have a good relationship with one another. The geo-based story was the first time I can remember the PLL no commenting on something in Sportico. So at this point, I will now disclaimer this as saying the following is completely speculation on my part and really of the reckless variety. The no comment to me is kind of a signal that maybe the board and league leadership aren't totally in agreement on a move to city-based teams. Consider again, the league regularly comments to Sportico. They seem to have a good relationship. It's all positive. They've delivered plenty of positive coverage, Sportico has. It seems like a really another positive story about growth in the future. So putting the geo-based story in Sportico 3 weeks ago and no commenting, it means someone didn't want it there, but other parties who knew about it put it out there anyway. Disagreement at the top about who thinks it should be there? I don't know. Pressure via a media outlet like Sportico is not some kind of newfangled tactic or anything tale as old as time. Obviously, media has been used to leverage situations, particularly in sports, all the time. I just found the no commenting curious, given like the positive relationship that they had. I'm probably just reading way too far into it. But like, to me, does it signal a disconnect of some kind between league leadership and the board, or some board members and other board members, or who knows? But it was interesting to me to see that happen. When a story gets no commented, it felt like it was there and somebody didn't want it to be. So anyway, Sportico originally put this out there back on May 3rd. So again, we've sort of done this recently. I did a quick pod about it when it happened. There are very, very few topics, though, in the lacrosse world that seem to get people just as fired up on the Bird app as this one. All you have to do is say city-based in a mirror three times, and some lax Twitter burner is going to appear to tell you why, like, Portland, Maine should have a PLL team, and then just scream grow the game at you until you collapse in tears. Really what the topic does is just, it kind of just gets everybody ahead of ourselves. We all just get super excited about, like, having a team in our backyards. Let's look at the announcement just a little bit. So beginning in 2024, all eight clubs assigned to home cities. Easy enough. That means the tour is done, right? Wrong. The tour is not done. Literally the third line of the announcement. The PLL will maintain its touring model with its eight teams playing in one city over a two-day weekend. Beginning in 2024, the home team will play a doubleheader when the league is competing in that team's market. So touring ain't going anywhere. At least not this year, next year, probably anytime soon. If you're that lax Twitter burner up in Portland and you get the Redwoods assigned to your city, congrats. That means the league will tour next year and the Portland Redwoods will have a doubleheader at home for one of those weekends. The way you are experiencing your fandom and the PLL as a fan is not changing this year or next year, really. There's some pull quote from Mike Rabel, who's the CEO you all know of the PLL, co-founder. Quote is, when we looked at our growth over the last 5 years, matched by our goals, objectives, and expansion, tying our teams to home cities was a natural next step for the business. From our major media rights deal with ESPN to the growing population of 45 million lacrosse fans across the U.S., the future of our sport is bright. Our team's presence in home cities will fuel our league's future growth by tapping into the most universally understood driver of fan engagement. So kind of maybe an interesting question here. I'm not the one who posed this originally. I was talking with another media person today who brought this up to me. But what if the PLL was just set up like this from jump, from the start? Toured with city-based teams. Why not do that? What if in year one, the Whips were the Baltimore Whips? And they toured, and they played a doubleheader at home whatever year. How much does that really change what's happened over the last 5 years? I'd imagine a little bit. Some of those trips to markets that might not have had a in air quotes, original six team is a little more awkward as fans kind of hunt who to cheer for, but the fans kind of figured that out on their own anyway, with or without the city-based thing. I guess there might be some fans who would be like, oh, I'm never cheering for a Boston team. I'm from New York or, you know, something like that. But, again, fans just kind of figured out where they wanted to be fans of anyway. So the end of the Mike Rabel quote made me think about that a little bit more. Our team's presence, the most universally understood driver of fan engagement. If it's that universally understood, why didn't we tap into it until year five? It just sort of happens that way sometimes, right? Like the thing we're doing wasn't a good thing until we started doing it. Or now we do it and it's good. You know, an ESPN streaming deal, when the MLL had it, it was bad. PLL has it, it's good. And the PLL is better. Like, don't get me wrong here. But, you know, it's just one of those things for me. Anyway, next in the announcement that was interesting, beginning June 3rd, fans will have the opportunity to vote on team locations at PLLvote.com and through the PLL app. The league will select cities based on industry-leading analysis, preferred venues, partnership considerations, fan engagement, and historical pro lacrosse ticket sales data. Look, if you're a fan and you go on the app to vote and you think it really means that your vote really is going to swing coming to your city or going somewhere else, I might have some tough news for you. And I talked about this a few weeks ago when we were talking about it the first time when Sportico reported it. But whenever this happens, whenever somebody says geo-based, even whispers it, immediately it's, okay, what team goes where? What team belongs to what city? Everyone's going to guess where they go. Again, very premature. And the focus when people do that tends to be on the wrong things. People, again, I'm gonna give you like the cold, hard business part of this. people want to make sure that we have to have teams in emerging markets. We have to have teams on the East Coast and the West Coast. We have to be represented across the country, all that stuff. Grow the game. Wrong approach. You put teams where people support teams. Yeah, Oregon, growing lacrosse market. Absolutely. Hanley and Dordovic, both from Oregon, both first-round picks a couple weeks ago. But if you can't beg 1,000 people to buy a ticket and get in the seats when you go there, then you can't put a team there. I'm not saying that's how it's been. This is hypothetical. East-West, new markets, whatever. Forget all that. The league needs to make money when they do this. This is a marketing, financial decision that can start sort of the growth you want to see in a startup. You have to still think of the league as a startup business. The growth that you kind of want to start seeing now. We're 5 years in. So the league should be looking at exactly what this announcement says they're looking at, right? Historical pro lacrosse ticket sales, fan engagement, partnerships, preferred venues. That's what you need to be doing. You go to the place where you sell the stands out, where people buy a ton of merch, and where lacrosse is already a popular sport, or it's, you know, in the growth kind of thing. So again, I always harp on Connecticut getting a team because I just find it checks all those boxes. And this doesn't necessarily mean you're just going to be like, okay, Dan, you have to then, all right, we're going to do the hotbeds and that's it. Nobody else gets a team. No, I'd put a team in Minnesota in a second. Definitely not a hotbed, not a traditional one, right? But they packed the place. That place was jumping last year. Everyone was wearing a jersey. Merch was selling like crazy, I'm sure. It looked great on TV. The venue was perfect. Like, if Minnesota does that again this year, absolutely put a team in Minnesota. You know, a place, and I hate to keep doing it because it's always like the example I run to, but like Atlanta is always a market where you talk about where the fan vote isn't going to be a big difference maker. I'm sure plenty of people in Atlanta will vote for a team to be in Atlanta on the app and all that stuff, whatever. But at the end of the day, like, people weren't showing up to Blaze games when the MLL was around. And when the PLL traveled there, the numbers were not good. The attendance, you could see it on TV, was just not good. For some reason, it's just a market that pounds the table saying, please come play here. And then when you do, when the PLL shows up, they don't. The fans don't. So if that's the kind of market that you're in, it might be, you know, time to make sure that ESPN Plus subscription is up. So look, again, we're talking years down the road here. I'm talking about how we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves, and here I am doing it. But you can't try and guess where a team's going to go as if this was the NFL, and making money is just going to happen because you're the NFL. It's like fantasy sports and funny money, like whatever. You got to put teams in places where they're going to make money, where you're going to put some money in your pockets. You're going to keep the lights on. Growing the game, I said this last time we did this, growing the game is great until you grow the game yourself into games with 500 people in the seats and you're on ESPN. That's no good. Now, off the top of my head, Albany, Baltimore, Denver, Connecticut, Minnesota, Charlotte. Those are places I think the support has been good enough. They've been to enough that I think that's kind of like a good starting list. I like the championship to be in Philadelphia every year. I think that venue is awesome for it. I think it's obviously a great city. I would wonder if they do that kind of thing where, look, you don't have a team based here. You're not going to be one of those, but you get the semis or the championship every year, something like that. But look, anyone else, if you're out there, you better show up in droves this summer. I know the PLL Social said that the Columbus, Ohio stop, the general admission tickets are already sold out for one of the days, something like that. Like, that's awesome. If you're in Ohio, that's how you vote. That's how you vote for your market to be considered. You sell the place out. You tell the PLL, when you come here, we're going to buy every ticket and we're going to buy all kinds of merch and we're going to, you know, pack the tailgate, the party scene outside, all that stuff. That's how you vote. That's how you let the PLL know you need to be here every year. Yeah, the PLL has raised a very impressive amount of money with a very large valuation. I don't think I can't say what the exact last number I heard was, not because I don't know it, because I shouldn't say it on the podcast, but The last valuation I heard of the PLL, I'll say this, was well north of $250 million. So that's as close to specific as I'm getting. That's massive. Massive. If that's the valuation that you're selling at, if that's the size league you are, or that's where you're, you know, where you stand in the sports world, then you need to be in big markets. You need to be in places that jive with that, you know, that have a good sized venue, that have all those things. So, but that's successfully selling some very serious growth on their part. Honestly, it's probably not too hard to sell. The geo thing, I think, plays into it as I see it, because they can say, look, we've got real footholds in these markets that have really taken a love to the PLL, and we're going to lean on those markets. Albany loves us for training camp and for that first stop every year. We're not just going to make it a first annual stop. We're going to give those fans a team to connect to, and we're going to go really hard on partnerships in that community. And it's going to drive, like, you know, rooting a team there is going to drive marketing dollars and things like that, that, that they might not have at the level that they would want to right now. You know, down the road, you're talking, all right, can we find a venue in Albany for just for a PLL team? This is where they play. This is where the Albany whoever plays. I think that's a few times over again with markets like Baltimore, Denver, Connecticut, again, even Minnesota. I think ultimately push comes to shove. It's time to start making money. The investors, look, they all are gazillionaires. We know that. Josiah's got enough money to do this forever. But I don't think they want to just keep cutting checks and saying goodbye to the money forever, right? If you want to make money, you got to go to the markets that are going to make you some money. Put some dollars in your coffers. Selling 300 tickets and 50 jerseys on a Saturday in Florida, it's not getting it done. Tour stop, sure. Regular market, probably not yet. The part of that that people were talking about today that I sort of downplayed as a whole was the community building thing, that marketing thing that I was just talking about. Of course, that's important. I just told you how much you can lean on that as a way to kind of sell this thing as a sign of growth. But I don't consider that maybe necessarily a near-term thing. Some of it is, because you're obviously going to start with that after this season, late this year, as you announce what markets are going to be your home markets. But I think the framing of the announcement is, hey, we're going city-based, and making it sound like it's like these teams are going to be in cities right now. They're all going to play in their home markets. They're going to play home and away games. That's not what this is. Framing it that way still just felt funky to me. We're still touring. The player experience is the same. They're touring. They've been touring since the MLL. The fan experience is the same. Still a touring league. They're still going to be in your market one weekend a year. Things are being built. Good. I get it. I know I'm coming across as Dan the Downer here. Everyone's fired up about this. PLL to the moon, rocket emojis, grow the game, groundbreaking shit, 24/7. I don't mean to poo-poo all that. Look, I mean, I should have opened with it, but look, the PLL had a hell of a day today. They rang the NASDAQ bell this morning. They made a league-defining announcement that's indicative of a serious commitment to becoming community-focused and getting to a place that fans have seemed to want them to go to every offseason. The questions are in order, expansion and city-based. When are those happening? One of them's happening now. That absolutely rules. And I think you'd have to be an idiot to suggest it's not awesome. But I think where I came from is, let's temper this idea of like, all right, let's attach the team to the city right now. Like, we're going to start playing like the NBA. We're not there yet. Nobody's going to Homewood five times a summer to catch a PLL game this summer or next summer, or probably not the summer after that. I don't know. That's all. So I still sincerely hope and believe, of course, that Connecticut should get a team. I'm well documented on that. You'd be crazy not to put one here. Please bring back the Barrage, or I'd even take the Hammerheads. All right. I can't believe I just spent all that time on this again for the second time in a month. But man, again, there is no topic on Lax Twitter that kills it quite like the city-based topic and gets me so triggered. I don't know what it is. Supernatural. Let's get to the real stuff, the stuff this weekend, the stuff that's happening now. College Final Four, semifinal number one, Duke, Penn State. Nittany Lions, we'll give you the spreads and everything here. Nittany Lions, an underdog, as you'd expect. They're currently getting four goals, plus 340 on the money line. All the spreads and all the odds and everything I give you will be from DraftKings. I don't line shop all that much because I don't have a ton of time to do it. If you do want to line shop, you should check out Hutton Jackson's feed on Twitter. He does a really good job of giving you regular updates on where the longest odds are for a particular bet so you can get best for your money if you feel a certain kind of way about something. But anyway, these are all from DraftKings. Penn State is +4, +340 on the money line. Looking back at the season as an underdog during the year, the Nittany Lions went 3-1 straight up and covered all four times. Four times an underdog, won the game outright three of them, covered all four. They were 8-3-1 overall against the spread in the regular season, but they do have yet to cover in the postseason. Favored in each of their playoff games, but 2-1 run record straight up, 0-3 against the spread in the playoffs, though. Duke is obviously -4, -450 on the money line. As a favorite this year, they went 10-1 straight up, covering, though, just five times. Obviously, they were favored a ton. They're Duke. Their record against the spread in the regular season, a very pedestrian 8-7. In the postseason, 1-1 against the spread. Obviously, they have not lost. They were 2-0. Not a great team against the spread, Duke. That said, this is May Duke we're talking about. Not even just normal May Duke. This is Memorial Day weekend Duke. Not just any Duke. This is one Infinity Stone away from snapping away the rest of the lacrosse universe, Duke. Brandon O'Neill, newly minted Raymond Denner's Award winner, will be the focal point all day, as you can imagine, for Duke, for Penn State, for the broadcast, for everybody. It's going to be all eyes on number 34. Penn State, I think, is going to have to go without Jack Posey. We'll kind of see what that looks like on Saturday. He had the injury against Army, the lower body injury that kept him out of the rest of that game. It did not look like he was anywhere close to being in a place to come back into that game. So I know some of the coaches met with media this week. I was not able to be part of that, but I don't know if there were big updates there, but it seems like we won't maybe know about if Jack Posey's going to go or not. But being short on defenders against Duke is a dangerous proposition. Nittany Lions have battled against teams with like heavy multitudes of weapons recently, and they sometimes have given up big totals, 15 to Michigan recently, 12 to Princeton. Duke has a slate of weapons that's really unlike anything Penn State has played this year. I don't think even Yale is like this. Yale's attack wasn't as good when they played as Yale finished the year with, but I think Penn State has shown a zone defense that's been very effective in recent weeks. I think you might see Penn State be in it from jump, from the opening whistle. It's come right out in the zone. You can kind of deal with two problems that way. First, you don't ask someone to guard Brandon O'Neill who can't guard him. If you're down some players or you don't trust the matchups, you go zone and you guard Brennan as a unit, as a team. You're ready to collapse on him if he dodges. You're ready to, you know, try and cut lanes as he tries to skip balls through you. Second, you can maybe stop the track meet a little bit. Zones do have that way of kind of grinding the pace of the game down. Penn State's chances in a shootout with Duke, I feel like, aren't great. I feel like if you're Penn State, a winning score should probably look like something like the Army games, like a 10-9, 12-11 kind of game, that neighborhood. You know, if somebody scores 15 goals in this one, it's probably a game that Penn State loses. The challenge with the zone is that Duke has, as they always do, the tools to just carve up a zone. I think, you know, if you come out in zone full stop, Duke can say, okay, McAdory, take the ball, draw, distribute, you trigger it. Brennan will just be over there waiting to catch a ball and shoot it. He doesn't have to be the primary initiator and distributor. McAdory can do that to his own. Dyson Williams can find whatever little window your zone leaves open and score from it. It's a pick-your-poison kind of thing. If it's me and I'm coordinating for Penn State, I think I'm going to try and play as much of that zone as I can. I'm going to ask McAdory, Williams, Ledman to all combine to beat me rather than daring Brennan O'Neill to do it, because I think he probably can. But on the other end of the field, you got Duke will try to handle TJ Malone. I think Kenny Brower will probably get the matchup there. Truth be told, hard to say who you pick to win that. I think Brower's been outstanding this year. He's been really good. Malone has been electric, particularly recently. I think Duke taking him away, if they can manage to do it, is very bad news for Penn State. I don't know if they can win without a big impact day from TJ Malone. Penn State has a lot of weapons, but a game with no impact from TJ would be hard to overcome. I remain very impressed by the Duke team defense and the way they defend off the ball. Stevenson, Boyer, Carpenter, all the shorties, they've been so good. Penn State has plenty of weapons. The game kind of needs somebody else after Malone to step up and take it over. The Trainer boys are obviously good candidates, both Matt and Jack. They're number one option kind of players on a lot of other teams. They'll need to play like that. I think Winkoff is going to have to hit some of those howitzer shots that kind of fire the team up and swing momentum. One of those, you know, missiles from 13 that goes bar down kind of thing. If he can do one of those early, kind of land that first punch with a shot that's the kind of shot that sets a tone for your whole day, I think that's the kind of thing that Penn State needs early in the game. I think they might need Duke's Wilhelm to cool off a little bit in net. He had, I think, his best game of the year in the quarters. I don't mean to sound like Penn State can't beat Duke here. I know I keep giving you all the things that must happen for Penn State to win. Penn State can win, but slaying the dragon here is a big task. I think you need a couple things to bounce your way. Faceoffs, absolutely critical. Mullins has been better lately, but you know, Will Coletti, I think, did eat him up pretty good. And look, Jake Naso's been the nation's best this year for me. Make it, take it, Duke is, I think, worst case scenario for Penn State. Even if you can hold out a little bit longer because you sit in the zone and you try and slow the game down, sooner or later, if Duke gets a runoff and because of the faceoff, the clock starts working against you. You know, you find yourself down maybe four or five goals in the third quarter and you can't win a faceoff. Can you stay in the zone anymore? Do you need to start being aggressive? Try and steal some possessions? That's when things that's Duke smelling blood right there, and that's dangerous. So I think Mullins and his wings need to be sharp. They need to try and keep things around 50-50 if they can. If they can win the battle, great. That'll give Penn State the chance they need. I think striving for 50-50 would be great for them. I think the upset is possible here. I think it's unlikely. I do like this Penn State team a lot. I've been kind of pumping them for most of the year. I think they throw enough zone. I think they throw enough junk at Duke to battle. I'm going to take Penn State plus +4. But I do have Duke advancing to the title game on Memorial Day. So I got Duke winning, but I got Penn State covering the plus +4. The next game, we got UVA and Notre Dame. Oh, that's the stuff. That's the just hook it into my veins.jpg right there. Round 3. The only team to beat Notre Dame this year is UVA, and they've done it twice. UVA's losses this year are Duke twice in Maryland, and both those teams lost to Notre Dame. All sorts of fun here. Breaking your brain on transitive property. UVA is a 1.5 goal favorite at plus +110. So if you really like UVA, you can get some value if you think they're going to win by a couple of goals here. They are a slight money line favorite at minus -130. UVA this year in the regular season was just 6-8 against the spread, as I saw it. Backdoor cover against UVA has happened a few times this year, you know, like that Harvard game, most notably, where they were, you know, they scored like 20 in the first half, but they wound up giving up a cover because they let Harvard score a ton of goals late and game was over. Their record is a favorite in the regular season, 9-3, but covered just 4 times in those 12 games. Postseason, they're 1-1 against the spread. Notre Dame comes in, they're plus +1.5. You obviously get trash value, minus -140. They are plus +100, even money, on the money line. In the regular season, Duke had one of the best records against the spread in the country. They were 9-3 against the spread, favored 11 times, covered an 8. Postseason, 1-1 against the spread. Notre Dame played one game as an underdog this year, just one. And they won outright against Maryland. I think this game could have a double-digit number of PLL pros in it. And that might just be on the offensive sides of the ball for between the two teams. It's like it's just weapons on weapons on weapons. For UVA, Schellenberger has been Mr. May again. 10 points in the quarters, NCAA record, obviously a man possessed. I think Chris Fake probably gets that assignment. And historically, you know, for me, as I look back at Fake, I've been on record about this. He's so much better guarding the big-bodied attackman. He'd rather guard Brennan O'Neill than Connor Schellenberger, I think. I'd like him better in that matchup. The smaller, quicker, change-of-direction players, the shiftier guys, have gotten the better of him more often than bigger players do. Fake is just more of a thumper, and you know he can do that against basically anybody. You saw him. Look, he locked up O'Neill. He guarded O'Neill extremely well. Schellenberger, though, makes this interesting, I think. UVA has used picks in the past and some of those earlier matchups, the second time they played in particular to try and free Schellenberger a little better. I wonder if that's a look they stick with. They rely on Shelley to do things on his own, or they can just pivot completely and remake what they do. Xander Dixon can become a primary Dodger. Schutz can. Basically anyone out there can. McConvey can. It's what makes UVA so hard to deal with. A guy I think you need to see having a big day on the Notre Dame defensive end is Ben Ramsey. I think if UVA finds a way to attack via an invert or find a short stick matchup they like, they're going to test them both. Ramsey will probably get tested a lot. If he's up to it and is winning his matchup on his own without a whole lot of slide help, that's a recipe for success for Notre Dame. I think stopping Notre Dame on the other end is about handling the Kavanaughs, obviously, and, you know, most people can't do that. I do like the UVA defenders here. I think Kastner gets Pat and Sostad gets Chris. I would expect is how that shakes out. You know, I said it when Notre Dame played Georgetown, and I stand by it. When UVA played Georgetown, I misspoke. But I stand by this. UVA defenders' length makes them just so brutal to dodge against. They're so tall, and their range is just insane. At stick's length, they'll just chew you up. They just cover more ground. They're more athletic. You will not find a blade of grass if you are at stick's length against Kastner and Sostad to run on. The thing is, for me, the Kavanaughs can play that way, where they try and play from stick's length and run around you, but they don't have to. They can play the speed game. They can also just be pit bulls. They can be surgeons. They can swing a sledgehammer at you. They can do either one. I feel like the latter of those feels like the likely approach for them here. We'll see if the UVA defenders can win a street fight, if I get into their body, if I really try and just out-muscle them. And the Kavanaughs do like to play that way. If Notre Dame can play a physical game with the attack in particular, I think they can create, maybe even draw a couple penalties. The Irish man up is basically automatic. I think Notre Dame can win by stealing a few goals with things like that, with the man up. I think if UVA comes out and does some 10-man riding and Notre Dame can attack it, you know, with guys like Tevlin just being athletic and fast enough to just get through and break the 10-man ride and you know, create some early offense kind of goals or give us one of those great TV goals from full field that makes everyone hate the 10-man ride. I think Notre Dame stealing a few goals that way is obviously a help for their chances. And the other two times they played, Notre Dame had 10 goals and 8 goals. I think those are their two lowest totals of the year. They're going to need to score more than that. Push pace, push tempo. You know, I think, I don't know if Quint coined the phrase, but I know I've heard him say it. Try and run on a runner. Try and push it, push the speed, even against UVA. I think LaSala makes that difficult. I'd give him a solid edge in this one, obviously, against Notre Dame and Will Lynch. I think faceoffs can let UVA dictate just how they want things to go tempo-wise. The low-scoring game, they've won it twice, is a game they can win. Notre Dame has played that game twice, obviously been unsuccessful both times. I think couple that, Matt Nunes has been hot lately. He's been playing extremely well. The specialist scales tilt towards Virginia, and I think that's a major part of this game. Hot goalie, hot faceoff guy in lacrosse is like the hot goalie in Stanley Cup hockey. I feel like this is a classic brewing, though. The stars, the stories, you know, all of it. You know, USILA All-Americans come out today. Pat Kavanaugh is second team, and the first team had 4 attackmen on it. CJ Kirst wins attackman of the year, not Pat Kavanaugh. I think a team full of guys who felt slighted after last year, maybe some of those attackmen feel a little bit slighted by the awards that just came out, and it adds fuel to their fire. Notre Dame is still playing, to me, as I watch them, pissed off and going scorched earth on everybody. I still think it's a motivator for them, even at this point. They are on a mission. I've got them winning the game. I've got them winning the biggest of the 3 times they've played UVA. I've got them going to the title game on Monday for another epic Duke-Notre Dame clash on Memorial Day. And that's the picks. I got Duke. I got Notre Dame doing the Memorial Day dance yet again. So, that being said, congratulations in advance to UVA and Penn State on making the championship. I will be in Philly all weekend. If you have a tailgate that's giving away food for nothing, please let me know. I would like to be fed. If you know cool spots that I absolutely must hit while I'm in town, love to do that too. If you know of any cool bars that will put on ESPN Plus showing box lacrosse at Saturday night in Philadelphia. Tell me about them because I want to go to those bars. I will also call out PLL team previews for the season are up over at sticksandlacrosse.com. All 8 up by the end of the day today on Friday, just in time for training camp to get started. Players are reporting. Those previews will have who the big additions are for every team, who were the big departures, sort of a rundown of how last year went and how this year could go, and then just sort of a guess at what each team's best case scenario is for the year. What's the best thing that could happen? And the worst case, the wheels totally fall off. Here's the worst thing that could happen for a team this season. So again, all those are up over at sticksandlacrosse.com. I do have a guest writer help me with one of those. Nate Lechter wrote the chaos for me, so that was awesome. You should go check that out. And just like that, it's all gas, no brakes. College championship. I will be in Albany the following weekend for the opening of the PLL season. It's a really fun weekend of lacrosse. Thank you again for sticking around with me. Make sure you tune in if you can find a stream. It's available somewhere to both the D2 and D3 National Championship games. There are excellent players. If you're a Chrome fan, you can see Cross Ferreira. You just drafted him. You can get a look at some guys who will be D1 next year. Spoiler alert with the portal there. But thank you again for sticking around with me today. And we'll see you next time. Enjoy the weekend, everybody.